I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. I'm just so excited to speak with you because I've been, I didn't realize there were other people like me out there. And I know you probably hear that all the time, but coming from a real fundamentalist background and then just kind of deconstructing and then also having a lot of what are impossible to describe to conservative Christians of I guess you'd say mystical experiences. And so then thinking, well, I don't even know how to describe these, let alone think, know if anybody else has these experiences until I read some of the Spanish mystics and realized this is actually a pretty legit thing that goes way, way back. And so then hearing your
farther
story.
Farther back than fundamentalism, even.
Yeah, and even into other traditions, too. So that could get me a witch trial right now.
Right.
So, yeah. So for people who don't know you or haven't heard your podcast, could you, in a nutshell, describe who you are and kind of a little bit of your journey and what you're up to right now?
Absolutely. My name is Mike McCarg, and people on the internet have dubbed me Science Mike. And that's just because my life and my work are about helping people make peace with their spiritual leanings, especially if they're in some form of Christian tradition, and how they understand the world through modern science. And that's what my work is all about, helping people make peace between their believer and their skeptic, their Jesus follower, and their inner atheist. Not necessarily even have one of those win the battle, but merely finding out how to live and move and operate in a world that can at times be antagonistic to both belief and doubt. Mm. And my work is about just making peace.
Mm. And you came from a very conservative Christian background, but then gave that up really and was a full-blown atheist and into science, but then came back around to belief in God, but not at all in the same way as you had before.
That's right.
So can you explain? I mean, that's also probably pretty hard to put into words as well, but I think you're going to be dealing with that in your upcoming book, right?
That's what the book is all about, yes. Mm. It's about my story of growing up Baptist, losing my faith, and becoming an atheist and rejecting Christianity completely, and then having this crazy mystical experience where I encountered God, but it didn't answer any of my questions. So what do I do with all these doubts and struggles and confusion? So it was all about, the book is about making that peace and figuring out how to move forward in my faith and how to find some toehold into the Christian tradition from a starting point of complete and total disbelief. It's called Finding God in the Waves, and it will be in bookstores on September 13th.
Mm. And what I love about your podcast, and you do the Ask Science Mike podcast, and then you do the Liturgist podcast, usually with Michael Gunger, and sometimes there's other people who come along in that. Maybe you can explain a little bit about what you do in both of those before I go on to explain what I like about them so much and why I think people should listen to them.
Well, the Liturgist podcast was the first of those two shows to start.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael and I started a collective called The Liturgist, where we wanted to create, you know, thoughtful, meaningful, spiritual art for people who are spiritually homeless and frustrated.
Mm.
So people who couldn't, who in some way longed for Christian community but couldn't walk through the door of a church, or they went to church every week but they left feeling kind of angry about it. And it was exhausting, so we decided to start a podcast to be able to release work less often but still keep a connection to the people we were cultivating a relationship with. And then the podcast became absurdly popular very fast compared to the other work. And in the Liturgist podcast, we take an idea or a topic and we look at it through the lenses of science, art, and faith, and we see how they inform each other. And It's actually one of the most popular podcasts in the religion and spirituality category on iTunes. It's completely unbelievable. And then some people who listen to the Liturgist podcast said, we wish we could talk about even more science. I was like, well, science is already really overrepresented of the three lenses on the show, so I can't talk about science more. And they said, what if you just started another podcast where you answer science questions? So that's where Ask Science Mike came from. It wasn't even my idea. So from the beginning, the people who follow my work have run that show. They ask the questions, they pick the questions, and I just show up and talk about whatever they want to talk about. And the point of Ask Science Mike is not that I'm some kind of knowledgeable expert, because I'm not. The point of Ask Science Mike is that questions are okay, and we can have discussions about difficult topics. We can be vulnerable. We can admit our ignorance, and we can explore the world together. And that's what that show is about.
Yeah. What I love about the show that is so refreshing, I haven't found this kind of blend very often or ever even, is that you're not pushing any agenda. There's a lot of science that you put up there, and you answer questions in a critical, skeptical fashion in terms of answering science questions on scientific terms, but you're really emotionally available and accessible, and there's no judgment. Some of the questions are like, there's the after hours one where you answer questions about pedophilia and all kinds of things, and it's just unique. I couldn't even believe that it was out there, and it was kind of like, wow, this exists. I can't even believe it. And so anybody who's listening to this, it's just a fantastic place to have all kinds of things answered, but also just in a way that I just love how you do it, Mike. It's just fantastic. You're very accessible and open, but there's a lot of things held in tension, but in such a way that is so gracious of spirit. So if that isn't meaningful life work, I don't know what is. So I just
remain intimately aware of my ignorance at all times. And so people like mistake that for humility, but it's really just like, I've been wrong so much in my life. I've learned to just expect sometimes I'm going to be wrong. Mm-hmm. So I better not ever get arrogant about what I think about things.
Well, as I was listening to your story, and you were talking about on one of the shows that you were on, and it might have been the James Talks podcast, and you were talking about your experience of being at the beach and just having this sort of mystical experience. And I'm sure that people who buy your book will be able to delve into your story more deeply. And I was wondering what goes on inside your mind as you spend all this time reading and studying and investigating how the brain works and how it perceives. And how have you avoided deconstructing and dismissing your personal mystical experiences in light of what has happened?
Because understanding the mechanism behind a miracle doesn't make it any less miraculous. So I can look at the Starry Night, this beautiful Van Gogh painting. It's my favorite in the world. And I can analyze it chemically, and I can understand that the lights and the colors I perceive are really just based on photons smacking into electrons, being absorbed into the atom, causing the orbit of an electron to jump up a few layers, then to collapse again, and then a photon of the difference of the two levels of those electron orbits is released. And that's why I see those blues and yellows and greens. And I can understand the photoreceptors in my retina that enable that through a nerve signal that goes to my visual cortex that becomes this electrochemical soup. And that does not mean that looking at the Starry Night is not beautiful, just because I can explain it scientifically. In the same way that the fact that I've got a pretty good handle on the neuroscience of spiritual experiences and even mystical experiences like I had on the beach, that doesn't mean those experiences aren't beautiful or meaningful. It doesn't mean that just because love is a chemical reaction in our brains that love is meaningless or not beautiful. It deepens my appreciation for my faith, for art, for beauty, to see the work of science help us understand how those things happen, but it does nothing to diminish the fragile beauty of that experience in the first place.
I love how you put that. And one of the things too, I think a lot of times you'll find in just pure materialist thinking is that once it's explained, then the beauty's gone or sucked out of it. But just being able to appreciate that you can know it both ways is sort of a miracle in itself as well. You know,
someone like Richard Feynman, who was definitely a materialist and a skeptic.
Yeah.
He was a great appreciator of the arts and saw science's ability to, you know, dig deeper as a way to deepen an appreciation of beauty. Carl Sagan was the same way. So I think that there, you know, most materialists aren't these like dry, detached observers. They're looking at like an epistemological claim on how reality works. But I don't think that cheapens the majesty and the awe of our universe at all. Just not at all.
So, as you see the divine, and it's not in a way, from what I understand and what you've said, you don't see the divine as described as Yahwistic, Judeo-Christian, typically defined as this pretty narrow idea of God and, you know, as having these human traits and things like that. God is more of a force or the source of our being, I've heard you say. And that's a much more impersonal view of God. And so it makes me wonder and be curious about how you see the Trinity and the persons of Trinity or Jesus as divine or incarnated. And how do you, and I'm sure it might be even in process and you might be wrestling with it. And how do you hold those things, or how have you seen those things developing as you perceive them?
Well, the first thing I would say is my theological ideas about God are deeply incomplete and fractured, and I know it. I know it. I start with the assumption that my understanding, my model, my personal conception of God does not fully depict the reality of God. And I'm comfortable with that. I spent most of my life trying to have this mastery over God to a total understanding of who God is or what God is. And I've just completely let go of that need. And instead, what I've learned to do is to trust God, which neurologically speaking is a much more useful toehold to knowing God. First of all, like, understanding God differently is the most Judeo-Christian thing you can do.
Right.
It's the most biblical thing you can do. If you look at this progression of an understanding of God in the Bible, even to say, you know, Yahweh is to look at a particular historical context for the Judeo-Christian God. The earlier God in the Bible was usually called some version of El. And so we've had this unfolding view of God where God started as one who walked with us in a garden and was personal, but the fall depicts a way in which we couldn't handle that intimacy, and God became more mysterious and distant. This I am that speaks through a burning bush and who embodies a pillar of cloud and fire and moves with his law in the Ark of the Covenant before dwelling into a temple. And when you see this indwelling, that's when you see the real Yahweh God, the God of a soil, who, like the other gods of that time in history, lorded over a domain. And that's why I want to read about the exile. The people cry out for Zion. They cry for a return to their home because they believe that's the only place they can know Yahweh is on that soil. And then you have this progression, this God of war, this distant God, this mystery in the Holy of Holies that once again becomes intimate, becomes knowable, has a face, has a name in Jesus. That's why the incarnation is important to me theologically as a Christian, because Jesus represents a God that we can know, a God that we can understand, a God who walks and talks like we do. And then that's not the end of the story. That's not the end of the repainting of who God is, because Jesus ascends, whatever that means. And then there's a Holy Spirit that comes and dwells with us, a deeply personal version of this distant mystery that once indwelled the Holy of Holies, that once hovered over the waters. But that's not the end of the story, because as we keep moving forward, then the church looks back historically and tries to make sense of these changing views of God in a theological idea called the Trinity. The Trinity is a first century idea. That doesn't make it not helpful or not beautiful. My point is, a God who we understand differently based on historical context is the most Judeo-Christian thing you can do.
Right.
So that's not some radical new thing. That's what we've always done. We've always been given an understanding of God that is appropriate for us to know and serve God in our time. So when I look at Trinity, I think it's beautiful to speak of a God, a Father, a Creator, I might even say a Mother, who creates and sustains the universe, but is frankly mysterious and inscrutable, because any God that can inhabit a state like singularity that the universe came from, that can encompass something like relativity that tells us that all coordinates of space-time exist all the time, is not a cause and effect being limited to a temporal perspective like us, and is therefore completely alien and can't be understood. But in a Trinitarian idea, you have a Christ, a reconciling force that has always been drawing creation back towards the unity of that God that was then incarnated in Jesus, Jesus the Christ. And then you have this Holy Spirit, this personal reflection of the divine that each person carries with them. And that fits remarkably well with my theological God, because I encounter a God in physics and cosmology that creates through a necessity of itself, that from a singularity, a universe is born. And from ongoing invisible fields like the Higgs field, continues to allow matter and space-time to exist. But this is a completely impersonal, almost Brahmic idea version of God. And that doesn't match with the God that we encounter in prayer and with Bible study and with spiritual practice. That is a God that comes alive within us, specifically in our brains. And so when I study a neurological God, that's when I start to see a Holy Spirit in that picture of God. And the thing that's drawing the two together, drawing that impersonal distance from our own reflection of that divine light, is the Christ. So I've grown to a point where, believe it or not, the Trinity is more essential to my faith and more essential to how I relate to God than it has ever been, even when I was a conservative evangelical.
Oh, yeah, I totally get that. That's kind of why the Celtics really touch me in their view of God too, because it's a different approach than essentially some of the Western Catholicism and Western Protestantism. Is a little more like Zeus. God is a little more like Zeus.
Sure.
And yeah, that's really, really fascinating.
And I just went way off the theological deep end there. I apologize. Trinity, well, and that just like got
yeah.
me.
Well,
that's studying a lot of Eastern Orthodox.
Yes, yeah, and that's interesting. So you're drawn to Eastern Orthodox in some of your readings lately?
Yes. Eastern Orthodox, and if I get into like Roman Catholic or Western mystics, any mystics make me not want to throw the book across the room.
Yeah. So what? Who in particular are you? Some of them that you're reading?
Oh man, I've been digesting for about a year and a half a book that I'm not even sure I can say it, called The Philokalia.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's probably, it's like a multi-volume sort of church fathers in the Eastern Orthodox tradition.
Right.
I think I'm on volume 5 right now. I have not read them in order, but I've done 1 through 5 now. And that's been, these aren't like, I read a lot of books. So I can pick up a book on neuroscience and read it in a couple days. These are books that I read differently. I wrestle with. I move slower. Now that, and people are going to be like, how do I spell that on Amazon? These aren't real accessible books. My favorite like accessible mystic is Richard Rohr. Like everybody loves Richard Rohr. Keating, Meriton, just, I don't know, just the regulars, the standards.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think then when you read about Eastern Orthodox, then you're, a lot of people don't really know too much about them, but it's when you really realize that Christianity is at its roots, at its most roots, it's really Eastern. It's a totally. Eastern spirituality, and that they talk about union with God and oneness. And then the mystical experience is for those of us who've had it, and I've one of those people, which is very difficult to describe to very conservative Christians because that's too woo woo. But then you realize, oh, this is like common vernacular for them, union with God and oneness and all that, which is sort of ineffable. That's just kind of how they roll. So it's not so weird after all.
Well, it's funny when you study like the Great Schism, where the Romans took the Greek invention of logic and started to apply it to theology. And the Eastern Fathers said, you can't do that. We made that. That's not what it's meant for. Mm. And it was this like battle between dogma and kerygma. That's one of the things that fueled the Great Schism. Mm. And of course, the Eastern Orthodox would say that all they did was stay in tune with original Christianity, mm-hmm. and the Romans just messed it up.
Right. So, yeah.
It's really fascinating.
Pointing fingers, and then that was that.
Karen Armstrong's book, A History of God, dives really deep into that, and it's fascinating.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's quite the book. That's quite the tome. Yeah, and there was another question I had for you, kind of on behalf of asking it on behalf of all the sort of weirdos out there like me, and it's kind of similar to what we're talking about here. But so I find myself leaning more towards trying to understand how we perceive the world and how we make meaning of the world through understanding how the brain works and understanding like neural pathways and perception and, you know, reading case studies and things like that. And I'm trying to do less magical thinking and thinking superstitiously and things like that, because I'm realizing how prone we are to those things. And I notice how common it is in religious contexts. And as I've been working in ministry with the incarcerated population, I notice a lot of magical thinking because of the desperation of the people that I'm working with. And it's really heightened my awareness of superstition within religious contexts. So it made me kind of extra interested in how the brain works. At the same time, then I find myself sort of falling outside of some conservative Christian boundaries by having some of my own mystical experiences, which I pretty much have never told almost anyone about, because it's really hard to describe. And also, until right now when this goes on, people are going to be like, she's a witch. So so my question is, and also the other thing is, I have often chalked up some of my experiences just outright to just having a really strange brain. I get migraines. I've had lucid dreams since I was like very, you know, primary school. And I actually always thought that everybody had lucid dreams at least several times a week, because I would have them so often. I developed sort of these muscles for, in a sense, muscles for lucid dreaming. And I just thought everybody did that. And, you know, I've had times of anxiety and depression, and I'm exceptionally creative. And so I just thought, I have an incredibly odd brain. And so maybe these experiences that I've had are just based on something inside my head that's just not quite right. And so, I don't want to, sometimes I think, well, maybe I can't attribute any of that to God. Maybe that's a cop-out. And so for anybody who's like me and weird and trying to puzzle things out like that, from your point of view and what you've read, do you think that mystical experiences or difficult to explain experiences have more to do with a person's just strange brain makeup? Or do you think that might be how God works? Or like, I guess I don't know whether to chalk that up to superstition or just a strange brain. I never really know what to think about what I've experienced, because as I lean more towards scientific things, I mean, you sort of covered this in one of your last things that you said, but as I wrestle with it personally, I don't want to be superstitious on the one end, but I don't want to just circle God out of what I'm experiencing either.
I think it would only be superstition if you were boxing in, when you use the word God, if you were using a really specific construct or definition for that word that is blatantly anti-science. Then it becomes superstition. I think if you're saying this experience I've had comes from God, and you hold that word God with a lot of openness, now you're just processing reality using language, which is what humans do. You know, in terms of like the propensity to these experiences, one of the most fascinating researchers on that topic is a woman named Tanya Lerman. She's an anthropologist with Stanford. And she had a book called When God Talks Back, where she did this really deep anthropological research into religious communities and people who experienced God in a very personal way. And she found several fascinating things. One, she found that people who scored high on something called the psychological absorption test, which is originally designed to help you understand how likely or unlikely you were to be hypnotized, really predicted how likely people were to find God very responsive in prayer. And she also found, you know, that when people pray a lot, they become more likely to have these kind of powerful experiences. In fact, she, a relatively unreligious person, had spent a lot of time in prayer because anthropologists are contact sport scientists. They don't distantly observe. They jump in. So she'd been involved in these very intense prayer activities, and she actually had, like, she calls them sensory overrides, but basically a mystical experience of her own, even without, like, a formal context for who or what God may be. And so what we find is that God experiences, spiritual experiences, are very much like any other skill. So some people are genetically, naturally very fast runners. Some people aren't. But if you take a genetically hardwired runner and they sit on a couch for 18 years, and another person who is not naturally a fast runner trains regularly and eats well and sleeps the right amount of hours, that person's actually going to run faster than the naturally fast runner. So our experiences with God, science is telling us, are an interplay between genetic factors and environmental factors, and then the kind of practices we carry out as an individual. So regardless of your starting point, if these kind of experiences matter to you, we're getting a good picture scientifically of the kind of disciplines or personal habits you should have to maximize your chances of having these kind of experiences, or maximize the feeling of closeness you might feel to a personal God. And they're well understood scientifically. And so I don't think that's like what science is so comforting for me is demonstrating the degree to which pursuit of experiences like these is not foolish, is not harmful, but is actually beneficial and helps us feel more secure in the world. And the output of that is able to respond to the world in a more loving way than we could otherwise. And to me, that's the Christ at work. And if it turns out that, like, all the claims of the most ardent materialists and skeptics are true, that any supernatural or mystical quality to God doesn't exist, I'm still comfortable calling my neurological predispositions toward spiritual experiences the spirit. And I'm still willing to call that way it plays out in the world in a way that makes my actions more beneficial to other people and indeed the environment, the Christ. That's a floor. It's just my experiences make me believe that's not all there is to it, but I'm comfortable if someone says no, those are the only things at play. That just, it doesn't bother me a bit.
Yeah, so she would have determined from her background and experience, I experienced something. I'm not going to call it God because I'm saying the brain does these things under these conditions. But the people around her would have said, oh, she had contact with God and
Holy Spirit. Good anthropologist, I don't think she would say either way. That's so Tanya Ullerman. If you follow her work, she's amazing, by the way. She's one of my favorite academics. But she doesn't talk a lot about her faith journey or her perspective, because as an anthropologist, her job is to fully embody human beliefs and cultures so that she can study, understand, and report on them.
Yeah, I did hear her on NPR, now that you mention her work. I remember hearing her speak on NPR, and it was interesting because she really took it full on and went all over the place to find out what people experience. And it's really fascinating. The brain is so fascinating. And I was speaking to Vinod Goel, who's a neuroscientist, and he was talking about charismatic experience and the brain, and how you can really easily replicate charismatic experience in Buddhism too. There's laughing yoga and things like that, which pretty much just looks just like charismatic experience, and it's in a different context. And it's not to say, I'm not saying that it's I don't know what's going on there. You know, maybe it is just something in the brain. Maybe it is a touch of the divine. I mean, do you think that, I think I heard you mention that maybe there's a part of the brain that's kind of working like an antenna. I don't know, maybe you could speak to that, what you mean by that.
I mean, so the question is, a lot of people get really uncomfortable with deeply materialistic views of reality. And they feel like that shuts the door on faith for them. And for those people, I say one way you could look at it is that the brain is a very sophisticated antenna, and that different brain states are tuning into some numinous reality. And so in that situation, the charismatics and the laughing Buddhists are both figuring out how to tune into the same frequency. And, you know, I'm not saying that's how it is. I'm saying that's one way you could look at things if a dualistic or non-materialistic view of reality is essential to you as a person.
Wow.
I always try to meet people where they are.
Yeah. And it seems like, now do you wind up getting, you seem to have a lot of love coming at you, and you approach things in a very gracious and loving way. Do you get haters that come at you?
Very little. Yeah. I mean, I recently had this like kind of massive, white supremacist alt-right Twitter mob. They mobbed me for a couple days, but
What that was about.
You hit block, you hit mute, you move on. The way I work, if people's intent is to engage in dialogue, I'm in, always. If the intent, even if they're right, even if they're wrong, I don't care, is to wound or to mock, I'm out. But that's such a rare occurrence for me. Overwhelmingly, my experiences with people from hardline anti-theists to conservative evangelicals to, you know, spiritual, not religious, I don't care what group people self-identify as, they tend to be incredibly kind and gracious to me and my work.
That's what I've noticed. And it's really interesting to me how, I think it's because you just come at things without hubris, and maybe you wouldn't think of it like that, but when people come at things open and with a lot of love, putting out a lot of love and generosity, I think it really does come back. I think it's just, I don't know if it's a law in the universe or something, but I've noticed that people really, really appreciate what you do. From you know, your fan base could maybe hate each other, but not hate you. It's just fantastic to watch. And I love seeing what you're up to. And
when I do live events, and I do a lot of them, all those people come and sit in a room together. And I don't get the vibe that they hate each other at all.
Good.
Everybody gets along really well, and people tend to go out for drinks afterwards. And I think, you know, Our media culture is so centered on intense conflict and animosity. And I think the new silent majority is people who aren't into that. And that there's just so few media expressions for people to latch onto. I think there's a lot of people who really don't care about my science and faith thing. And they just like hearing civil discussions across ideological lines. And they come along for that reason. And I don't know. I, And I don't think about that much other than just like incredible gratitude, mm-hmm. because there's always the next thing I've got to get done, the next podcast, the next whatever. but I have noticed, especially when I talk to other people with public platforms, mm-hmm. they're like, how do you deal with the help? How do you deal with this? I'm like, what are you talking about? I get less than one negative email per month. And wow. I get like, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 emails a month. So it's a really tiny percentage.
Mm. And so with regards to your book and your tour, can you tell us what you have planned for some of that?
Sure. The book comes out September the 13th. Mm-hmm. And we're going to hit a bunch of cities with either Ask Science Mike Live events or... you know, Sunday morning appearances at churches, whatever. Mm-hmm. We're going to try to go to 18 to 20 of the biggest download markets. Mm-hmm. And then we're also going to have ways that people, if they're not one of those cities, but they really want me to come, ways to get me there that are less expensive than usual. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually going to have some information on that on the book's website, findinggodinthewaves.com, that will actually be out by the time this show airs. It's not out there now, but it will mm-hmm. be then.
Oh, that's great.
I just broke the fourth wall. Sorry.
Break it away. Okay.
Well, everybody listening, like their brains like automatically just feel like they're in a conversation that's happening right now. And I just create a distance to reveal like a little tension in the neurological makeup and their model that, oh, wait, no, yeah, this is definitely pre-recorded.
It's not happening right now.
Not happening
Everyone's
right
just
now.
Shattered. Well, I did send you a couple questions, and I don't want to pressure you if you're stuck for time and you have to be somewhere else or anything. I don't know if you had.
We've got 15 minutes. We're good.
Okay, I asked you about Schadenfreude. I probably just said that wrong, and.
German words are tough.
Yes, especially for me. And the other one was matrilineal. Why matrilineal societies aren't more prevalent. I mean, I kind of have a hunch as to what you would probably say. But then as I was talking about lucid dreaming, then I was like, dang it, why didn't I ask him about that? That's the real one I want to know.
Well, we can talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Well, I guess those would be, I'd love to just see what you have to say about all of those if you have the time. Just Mike McHarg has been amazing as a guest, and this episode has been more about theology than I was expecting. And now comes some of the sciencey stuff that I was expecting. And I asked him some really great questions. We talk about dreams and lucid dreams, that pleasure you get sometimes when other people have misfortune that you feel really guilty about. I wanted to ask him about that. That was a really fascinating answer he gives. And also he talks about the genetic advantages we have regarding gender and the evolutionary processes that brought that about. It's really fascinating. I also got to ask him about when humans started developing an understanding of God and how that might have happened. Such fascinating answers. But a lot of times I like to save some very special goodies for my Patreon supporters. And this whole episode so far is probably worth at least $10 or $20. And this next part is another 17 minutes or so, is probably worth another $10. If you'd like to support the show, it'll only cost you $1 to listen to the rest of this. So I highly encourage you to head over to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is spelled like patron with an E, Patreon. And get a hold of this. And when you subscribe, you also get a lot of other goodies and extras and specials. When you subscribe at $5 a month, you get the Varsity Club stuff, which is a lot of videos, lessons that I put together for Soul School, and special events that are exclusive, that are private events where I invite guests and we do kind of a secret club meetings that are really fun. So I hope this will tantalize you to come and support the show and hear his fantastic answers. I just love Mike so much, and I hope you will tune into his program, and I hope you really enjoyed the show. Thank you so much for listening. come to sparkmymuse.com for show notes to this episode and all episodes. There will be links to the people, books, and resources mentioned in the show, and sometimes you'll find photos or embedded videos too, and lots of other goodies.